I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today I'm here with Alan Small to talk to us about science clubs and all of these things that get us excited about science. I am too excited about this episode. All right, Alan, we are sitting in here on, surprisingly, a Friday.
As it goes.
How are we doing?
Doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. I appreciate you having me in.
In a turn of events, it is snowing.
Unbelievably.
In Texas.
Yes.
Which any teacher who has ever taught in an area where it's going to snow knows what that does to kids who don't see snow that often.
They immediately run to the windows and bang on them and beg to go outside.
And that's all they did. I was like, and I was doing a real task intensive lesson today, and it was just insane. I mean, I was like,
close
all right,
blinds,
yeah, I just, yeah, that, literally, my room's dark because I was like, it's not happening.
Yep,
snow is not that important.
No, you'll see
what I'm doing. Yeah, what I'm doing is important. Snowing in Texas, fun times. Recording on a Friday again, unbelievable. It just happens that way. Anyway, Alan. Super excited to have you. I'm just a quick backstory for the listeners. You actually, you know, you kind of contacted me just a little bit about, you know, the podcast. And then we got talking about what you did. And immediately I was like, I need him on the episode. So we made it happen. I'm glad you're here. So first and foremost, we got to tell everyone who you are so they know who they're dealing with, why you're here. So go ahead, tell us a little bit about yourself, your focus, and what your role is, where you're at.
Well, I really appreciate you having me out. I've been, you know, I'm a big fanboy of your of your work and your podcast and what you're up to. I'm a science guy. I like doing sciencey things. But I recently started working in out-of-school spaces and after-school programs and using that time as a lever to help science education. I'm kind of a... There's three of me at the moment. I work with the Texas Partnership for Out-of-School Time, and we connect after-school programs and formal school programs and business partners all in one collaborative heap to work together to improve after-school programs and out-of-school time. But I'm also the stream and coding coordinator for a local school district, Castleberry ISD, just up the way, not too far down the street.
Shout out to any Castleberry people listening.
Woo woo, that's right. Go Lions. Very good. Yeah, we got some good things going on there. I help with elementary schools, all the elementary schools. We're working on coding and robotics at those levels, and a lot of fun, a lot of good people doing some good work there. And then I organize my own science clubs with Worth Learning. That's the name of the company that I work in with my wife. We co-own that and set up science clubs all around town. Anywhere we can have an in for fun science, we're on it. So that's me.
So you're doing it with your wife.
She does the office, and I do the science slinging.
So that's awesome.
We tag team it.
That's cool. Right. Yeah. So is she a big science person too, or is she the business head?
She's the business head. We actually met working at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History here in town. We both worked there, and she does the management, and I do the science, and we make a good team of it.
That's awesome.
So it's a lot of fun.
It's good stuff. Yeah, I can imagine. So you mentioned that you're doing, that you kind of set up clubs anywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? Just real quick, like, where is this, like, you, how do you decide where these clubs are going to be? Is it just, well, we want to set up here, and you run that? Like, where does that process come from?
I've had different versions of it. I started when I was a teacher, and I was teaching elementary school, and I just needed a release valve for myself. I needed a way to get to that content that we didn't have time for, mm-hmm. and so I just said, hey, guys, you know, we're going to have a science club. Anybody who wants to join, come on down, and we're going to have as much fun as we can, and we'd meet once a week, and, you know, the class would fill up before I could get back to my, you know, get back to the copy machine to print more flyers. And then when I started doing that full time, we would approach campuses who needed after-school programming, and we'd rent space from them, and parents would sign their kids up. And so that's what we do now. We'll visit with school districts who have an interest in quality after-school programs, and we'll rent space from them and recruit students and have fun once a week all year long.
That's awesome.
So it's a lot of fun.
I mean, it's just, I'm just like, watch. I'm like, I wish I was a kid Because I would totally sign up for something like that. Because it didn't, that, I don't, you know, I could be wrong, but when I was younger, I didn't have access to it. There was nothing like that around, you know, science teachers who are listening. I want to ask, you know, why, you know, you started doing science clubs because you wanted to get to the content so bad and you just didn't have time for it in your classroom. So why science? Why is it this crazy passion that you're like, you know what, I can't get to it in class, so I'm going to do it even more outside. What is it that's driving you to do all of this work with it?
Well, it's funny that you mention that you wish you had access to it as a child, because I did. Whenever I was, I guess, 3 years old, that same museum, the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History, would have museum school classes. And at that point, parents would have to, like, camp the night before, big long lines in the parking lot with lawn chairs. And they'd sign their kids up and have museum school. And I did museum school all the way up until sixth grade, which is when they stopped doing museum school. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in the seventh grade, my mother lied and said I was in the sixth grade again and signed me up again. And then after that, they offered me a chance to come be an assistant in some of those science programs. And so I just never left. And so it kind of invaded my soul, so to speak. And just really, I have a love for the cool science activities, and it's because of that early access, I think. And so getting into the classroom with students and doing awesome science things, you know, I really enjoy that. But, you know, teachers all know there's way, the minutes in the day are too few.
Yeah.
And if you want to have your hands on something that's fun enough for everybody to have a sigh of relief at the end, then you almost have to leverage that out-of-school time or summertime or access on a Saturday or something to where you're not constrained by the bell, and you can just do it.
Yeah, and, you know, now that you mention it, I'm just thinking, you know, I've never taught science, but in a science classroom, you know, here at our middle school, you know, our class is like 45, 50 minutes long, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost to where you have to make sure your experiment can fit in that, or, you know, whatever demonstration you're doing.
Yes.
And that seems like, you know, and in reading, we have the similar restraints to where, you know, we can do short stories or longer works, but, you know, we're limited by how much time, paper, copy, clicks, you know, all of this stuff.
Yes.
And that seems like that would be, you can't just stop and experiment halfway.
It's absurdly difficult.
Yeah.
Because the next class is coming in. And even if you could leave it halfway, the next class has to use the equipment.
Yeah.
So you have to compress it all in to that 45 minute time. You have to teach, you know, 5 billion years of rock cycle in 45 minutes. Good.
Yeah, and science is so detailed. I mean, there is, to teach kids the scientific method, to really get them to explore and ask good questions and find out the repercussions of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's a process.
Totally. Yep. It very much is. And one of the things that I fight against is students who feel like they're looking for the answer, as if there's a blank in their brain. If they get that answer, then they can stop the activity. Well, in science clubs and these after-school programs, we just go. You know, we build a roller coaster, and we just build it longer. And then we just build it longer or higher or faster. And so it gives us that chance to not get the answer or get the it, but actually have some exploration.
Yeah. I mean, that's... My brain is just whirling. Like, the what you just said, you know, you just keep going. Keep pushing. It's like, okay, well, we found this out, so, you know, let's turn this corner, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see where this is going. I mean, do you have kids that, like, in these sessions, right, I guess what you could call them, or in these moments where you're running these experiments,
yeah,
do they often, is it hard for them to take that to where it just to push it? Because a lot of kids are like, okay, I want the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What's the answer? What's the answer, small?
That's right. Right? What is it? I got it. Well, there's two things that affect that. The first one is the group that comes to us is kind of a self-selected group. You know, they're really into science and they've got access after school. They've got a time block to do it. So our folks are into it, or they want to be into it. But they are also coming right out of their regular scheduled programming, so to speak. They've been in class all day long, doing their regular things. And so getting them to jump from that assessed test-taking mentality mm-hmm. to, hey, we're going to get dirty, or it's going to get wet, or it's going to be sandy.
Yeah.
They almost leap towards it. but there are a few kids who do have to be pulled along to the point where they're active in the science rather than just trying to understand it.
So we're going to jump to a different subject real quick, but we're going to get back to that once we really start diving into, you know, what these clubs are. But before that, I want to keep laying this foundation. Why do you think it's valuable that these clubs exist? Why do you think this science education that you're doing, you know, why should people listening to this right now, why should they be paying attention to, you know, the types of things you're doing with science for these kiddos?
Well, when I was in the classroom, I didn't quite understand what was available. I did not understand the excitement or the freedom that was available in that after-school space, but I also didn't understand the importance of it. But high-quality out-of-school time, which, by the way, for listeners, for teachers, the acronym is OST. If you ever see OST, that's out-of-school time, and I didn't know that as mm-hmm. when I was in formal education. But high-quality out-of-school time helps a huge number of categories. It increases critical emotional skills, academic, social skills. It reduces dropout rates. It helps parents keep their jobs. So having like quality programs for kids after school is just like a huge perfect support that every teacher wishes was there. But also, there's some freedom there that the students can pursue some interest that they couldn't do in that 45-minute block. If they wanted to try coding, if they wanted to try robotics, if they wanted to try dissection, then they can have access to that in a quality program.
It's almost giving them, you know, it's the same concept of getting kids into sports, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a similar thing, but more academic. Mm-hmm. Is there a goal to get kids that maybe not necessarily would have wanted extra science just to see if they're into it? Or Sure. Is it really just going after certain kids that show an affinity for the science world?
Sure, sure. When I was in the classroom, it was first come, first serve, come as you are until the door, you know, until we're full and we'll close the doors and we'll let you know when we have room.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked with some principals in the past who had very specific needs on their campus. You know, maybe they needed more concrete skills with their students, and they would dictate and say, our fifth grade students need access to this program until assessment time, until the state standard test is here. And, you know, I'm happy to work with those students. I love doing that sort of thing. But I have noticed that narrow field does dampen the activities that happen in the lab just because of the depth of the students who show up. You know, if it's a very rarefied, you know, if only fifth graders show up, you get a fifth grade perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In my favorite way of doing it, I open it up to everybody on campus. You know, if it's elementary, I say, you know, K-5, whoever you are, if you're interested, we've got 25 slots, you know, come on down, we'll get you in. Here's our monthly dues, but if you don't have it, come on. Never turn anybody away for money, because if there's somebody who's that really wanting to be in there, I want them to come tell me what they're interested in.
Sure.
And that K-5, or if it's middle school, that 6-8, having that mixed age group, it just does something magic. And you know, if the kindergartner starts to get behind, the fifth grader will pull them along. Or if the fifth grader gets bored, that kindergartner is sure gonna make things interesting for kindergarten. And the same thing happens at the middle school level, because the depth of experience on those grade levels is just so varied that you get a really rich experience. So I've done it all three ways. They all work. But my favorite in the way that I do it now is just invite anybody who's interested. And then when we're full, we're full.
Tell me this process of you getting these kids into the club.
I've got to get yeses from several people. I've got to get yeses from campus administration who want us, you know, they want the program on their campus.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get yeses from parents who say, yeah, I see quality and value in that program. I'm going to send my kids to that program. And I've got to get yeses from the students themselves who are like, yeah, that sounds cool. I want to do that. And there's different levers to pull for each one of those. So for the administrators, they've got to see academic value. And so what I do, at least here in Texas, I figure out what the lowest performing standards were on the last state test. And I just pull from those standards. Now, I don't tell the kids that. I don't even say the word standards to the kids. But that's how I get yeses from administrators, because that's how I create value for them. And for the students, I make sure it's hands-on, it's dirty. We're not reading and writing anything that's not necessary for making the dirt happen. Mm-hmm. It's accessible to each student, so I get yeses from them. And generally, if I can get those two, parents are quick with a yes, and I can get yeses across all three. So that's how I set that up.
That's awesome. I like the idea of attacking those specific standards that kids are struggling with. And I imagine they vary from all over the place, depending on where you're at, right?
I mean, and the beauty of the science club thing, like when I was in the classroom, like teaching fifth grade science, which if you're not in Texas, fifth grade is the first year science is assessed on the state test. So it's like a big deal. But sitting in the classroom with my students, it was very difficult to see the wide swath or the wide palette of labs and activities that were available, because I just knew, okay, we're behind in this. I've got to attack this tomorrow. We're going to do this real hard, real fast, and we're going to... Well, stepping back into a science club, more relaxed model, we're still hitting those standards, but I have a moment to breathe, and I can find five or six really fun things, really cool things to do that students find value in themselves. Well, after doing science club and having those activities, I can pull those back into the classroom, and it improves my regular formal instruction too. So at least that's how it has been for me too. It's been kind of a reward I didn't see coming.
Sure. So, you know, since that you were a teacher and now you're not, a question that kind of came up when I was thinking of, you know, what we could talk about was, you know, what do you see that schools are not doing to increase science education or that passion? Because I imagine you have a different perspective of what schools are doing now that you're kind of on the outside, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you're in it, but you're still kind of the outsider because, you're not in the class.
Right, I'm around it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just from this, because teachers, you know, what's funny about doing this podcast is it feels like we're in an echo chamber sometimes, right? And it's really easy to feel like that if you're the actual teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, you're struggling with your content, maybe, or your kids aren't grasping the things that you want them to grasp. Sometimes it feels like you're in this little bubble and no one exists and you're just lost and there's no resources and all these other things. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From the outside, from your new perspective, what have you seen that schools are missing, or maybe not missing to put it in a negative light, but they're not having access to, if that makes sense?
Science is one of those, it's a crazy thing, because to do it well, you have to make a mess. And I don't mean just like slinging mud. You have to be okay with a messy investigation. Mm-hmm. It has to be more open-ended than, I will teach you the colors of the rainbow. They are Roy G. Biv. Now, say the colors of the rainbow. Kids can remember that, like it's a word trick and you've got it, but they don't have rainbow and mm-hmm. they don't have weather that they need. So having schools let go a little bit and get back to that, hands-on is way overused, but get to activities that kids are actually doing something.
Mm-hmm.
I get twitchy when pencils and paper come out too soon. they're an important part of it. We're assessed on a 2D paper. You know, in Texas, our assessments are two-dimensional written things, so our students need to be familiar with that. But in science, they're assessed on a two-dimensional thing that's talking about three-dimensional processes and objects and things. So if they haven't learned three-dimensional things, they're not ready to be assessed on it on a two-dimensional thing. So we've got to get students jumping back and forth. We've got to give them the 3D, let them play with it, slobber on it, and drop it on the floor and break it and cut it open. And then we've got to bring that to paper, bring that to drawings, bring that to sentences, the written word, and then help them jump back, refer back to their experiences in the 3D. And there's a lot of fear, I think, of, you know, teachers don't have familiarity with a rock collection or a dead cat or going fishing or building a roller coaster
mm-hmm.
or observing the weather or sitting in the grass. And those are all things that, you know, some people will love certain ones and hate other ones of them, but they're all concrete experiences that kids, once they've done that thing, they can reference that on paper and be successful. We just have to give them that thing in 3D first.
You know, it makes a lot of sense because, the way the brain works, you know, a lot of new studies have come out, but one thing that's fairly common is, you know, we remember experiences far easier than we remember most anything else, especially at a kid's age. It's harder for them to memorize This is why, you know, writing and reading and those academic things are tough, because they remember their experiences, they remember their feelings, or they can recall those things better. And what the science has going for it is you can create those experiences. You can, rather than, you know, talking about the way the dirt is and what it's made of, you can go out there and grab the dirt.
Well, there's a weird trap for science teachers, too, in that you read the standard on a 2D paper, and it says, Johnny, Susie, and Javier will know this. Yeah. And then the paper, you know, at the end, there's a paper test that say that's going to assess that. But if you get to the class and you tell those kids that concept, and even if they remember it, the text on that assessment is not going to say, what did your teacher tell you was this concept? That it's going to create a scenario that's totally, you know, a totally made up fictitious thing that students have to visualize. And if they don't have the concrete 3D experience to pull from, they won't be able to create a model in their brains about what that even looks like. And they'll do poorly. So you've got to give them that 3D concrete experience.
Yeah. You know, how do we expect them to understand certain things about science and certain things that are very physical, right? Physical science. You know, how do we expect them to understand that when they've never seen it or never come into contact, never experienced what it's talking about? I mean, imagine if you lived in a world where you never dealt with a magnet and someone gave you a piece of paper telling you what a magnet did or showed you how it worked. You have, that doesn't show you how cool a magnet is.
Yep. Or gravity. Thank goodness we're sitting here. Yeah.
Gravity is a really hilarious one because it's so obvious and around us, but you know, once you connect the science with it, it becomes a different thing almost. Mm-hmm. And biology, I think biology is probably one of the most important qualities about this, because the whole basis of modern biology is Darwin's work and, you know, people branching off from that in a lot of ways. And those things, you know, you can read about them, but you can also go out into the world and literally see species changing and the fossil record and all these other cool things that you can experience.
Sure, sure. Well, it just goes in science. You can just jump into so many different areas and play and have fun.
Sure.
And that's me in science clubs. Like, okay, we exhausted that. You know, we beat that dead horse last week. We're going to come try this whole new thing. This time we're making, you know, we're going to make animation this next week, or we're going to make whatever cool project.
Yeah.
I do think, I want to share kind of a related experience that I had just this last week that had to do with giving students that concrete activity before trying to bring them to the learning. Just giving them the experience with their hands on, because I totally wrecked one this last week. We were actually doing some new little robots with some educators. Like, we were grown ups. I was grown up. We were all having fun. and they're little bots that follow lines on paper, Ozobots. You draw a line on paper and the robot follows the line. And I had been playing with them all over the Christmas break. So I had like a couple of weeks to really get to know these things and do some cool little art things with them and just have fun. And I passed them out to these educators they got them in their hands, and they immediately oohed and awed and started working. And, you know, I gave them like 5 whole minutes to get to know these robots. And then I said, okay, here's your first challenge. And I took it straight to paper and, like, straight to the education. And I didn't give them a chance to, like, chew on it and, like, play with it and figure out what it was, what it wasn't. And they went with me. Like, they tried it, but they all fell so hard, just right on their faces, because they hadn't. They didn't know. They'd only had 5 minutes with those robots.
Yeah.
And then they were irritated. And they were nice to me, but the frustration was so apparent that it really made the lesson lag until we went back to that play and that hands-on just observation, exploration that I didn't realize had to happen even with robots. You know, I know it has to happen with roller coasters, but I didn't know it had to happen with robots. And so giving students a chance to put their hands on it and fully experience some aspect of whatever you're teaching, it's gotten higher in the importance rank in my mind.
Yeah, and you know, funny point, I won't stay on it too long, but with reading, you'd be surprised, like, you know, you talk to a lot of reading teachers, and it's like, when are they touching books, right? When are you flipping pages? When are they, like, because book is it's a very physical thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids, they don't grow up with books in their houses anymore. Or you know, it's just not a part of their culture, and they don't go to libraries, and you don't go to bookstores, and you don't find, you know, there's not even books in grocery stores really anymore. There's like tiny little sections.
You have to look for Archie now.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I've, you know, it's just like every once in a while I'll just pass out a bunch of books and just let them flip and look, and it's that going back to that experience thing, mm-hmm. right? Put it in your hands. Figure it out first before we start talking about it. Hopefully by now, if they weren't sold on clubs or pushing the science education, we just sold them, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
A teacher, a science teacher, listen to this, the head of a department, someone in curriculum, whoever, how do they take what you're saying? How do we take the need for more physical things to get kids those experiences in science? How do we get that want and make it a practical, achievable thing for them?
For me, if it's a standard that has an object that you can put your hands on, you should do that. And, you know, there's some standards that are sun, moon, and stars. We're just not going to be able to not do that. But if it's some aspect of physics or some aspect of chemistry that is accessible, it should be a do. It should not be a read about or a hear about, you know, a video. It's fine, but it's not doing. I'd say, you know, a video in some cases is way superior to reading or hearing about something. But being able to put your hands on it and do it is important. I've heard all sorts of different opinions about Pinterest in science, because some folks use Pinterest to go find their next best worksheet, mm-hmm. and that drives coordinators crazy.
Yeah.
Because
that's everywhere, too.
Yeah, it's just a common thing. And so coordinators just kind of say across the board, don't go to Pinterest, don't look at it, don't. It's off limits, against the rules. But platforms like that aren't just worksheets. They've got access to all different sorts of legitimate resources that are, you know, how to build cool things, how to make models that work, how to make things that students can do. And soda bottles and dirt, you know, you can hit all sorts of earth science standards, and everybody's got access to soda bottles and dirt and a water faucet. I mean, there's not much excuse. There's some excuses, but there's not much excuse for not giving students access to the direct, dirty fingernailed type of activities that make for a successful science program.
So really, first step would be, if whatever standard they're looking at, if it's something that you can bring into the classroom, do it.
Yeah, totally do it. And I know, sitting in my classroom, it was really hard to figure out, okay, how am I going to make this happen? And I've gotten much better at either researching or crowdsurfing, crowdsourcing ideas. But for me, those partnerships that I've started to try to make, those save my hide over and over and over. I can call, you know, I can call the science coordinator in Casper, Denise Fisher. She's, you know, guru extraordinaire. She's worked, you know, hands-on this and assessment that. She knows what I can do. Or I can, you know, call somebody at the museum. I know a person or two there, and they can direct me. Or I can, you know, I can go down the way to the middle school science teacher, who she's done many things. But if I'm stumped, I can find help. And it's some connection, some partnership that'll get me the data, get me the information to start a lab that I haven't done in the past. And then once I've done it once, it's golden. You just do it whenever you need it.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on of science education in America.
For science, over two-thirds, I like this fun fact, over two-thirds of Nobel Prize winners in science found their passion area outside of the classroom. So, you know, thank goodness we have all these Nobel Prize winners and their wonderful advancements, but they didn't get it sitting in biology. They did not get it sitting in their chemistry or physics class, by and large. They found it in an informal setting. They found it at a museum. They found it from an uncle who let them burn something, you know, in an interesting way. Outside of the classroom is a huge lever that, up until, you know, a couple of years ago, I didn't even consider.
See, and do you think that falls to kind of the fault of where we've taken science education and public education, to where we've moved away from the more physical, touching things, more experiments? I mean, do you think that's a symptom or related somehow? I mean, what are your thoughts on, like, the things that we're seeing, to where a lot of our advancements in science don't come from, you know, American born and raised people, but most, you know, a lot of our science innovation that is in America comes from, you know, immigrants mm-hmm. and whatnot. Do you think that's a symptom of the way science has changed in our public schools?
There's a lot of fear in the science classroom, and there's a lot of fear in the teachers, and then that kind of breeds fear in the students. There's fear of getting hurt, and it's way overblown in most cases. And there's fear of looking stupid. There's mm-hmm. fear, you know, if I don't know what this is, then I can't really talk about that, and we're not going to bring it up. One of my favorite activities is an engineering challenge where you balance a certain number of nails on the head of a single nail that's been nailed into a block of wood. So you take the block, nail one nail in so it stands up, and then you balance all the others on there. And students love it. Parents like it when it comes home. I like doing it. It's fun. But when I bring it into teachers' classrooms, the first question I get is, won't they hit their fingers with a hammer? And it's, you know, these are experienced educators. This
sure.
is not, and the fear is someone is going to be terribly injured by hitting themselves with a hammer.
Yeah.
Or, but I, you know, I also hear, won't so-and-so hit the other students with a hammer? I've never, you know, I have done that activity with over 1,000 people, and I've never seen anybody hit anybody with a hammer. But it's the first thing that pops up in mind because people are scared.
Yeah.
And they don't want to get in trouble, you know, if their administrator comes down Monday morning and says, so, I hear that you had a hammer fight in your room last Saturday or last week. So that fear really hampers things. But that other fear of looking dumb, if you don't know what the content is and you can't approach it, why would you go there and risk looking silly? But the key is you don't have to know it. You don't even have to show students, you don't even have to imply that you know it. If you have the rock and you're able to ask questions in front of students and model for them that investigation, you're doing it. It's probably better in some cases that you don't know it so that you can work with your students to hunt for those answers. So fear of looking uninformed is a big barrier, and unjustified fear of injury is another barrier that hopefully we can get folks past.
Yeah, and that, you know, I mean, you see it everywhere. I mean, as soon as you said it, I was like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, because it's everywhere. I mean, teachers are, you know, afraid of lawsuit this, they're afraid of lawsuit that. Certain administrators are very much, afraid of kind of pushing boundaries. What's funny is it's not really pushing boundaries with this type of stuff. Like, you would think we were talking about, like, you know, bringing certain types of media into the classroom, mm-hmm. right? That real, you know, we're real edgy. We're talking about like dealing with science. Nails. Yeah, it's just, it's kind of insane. It's like, it's.
Another common theme is hearing from educators, but you don't know my students.
Yep.
And all of our students are special, and we all know our special facets of our kids, but we've all got those two kids in each class that, you know, try our patience and, we're going to stand extra close to them while they hammer their nail, but it can be done. And I don't think the fear, I think the fear is overblown.
Yeah. I think I agree with you. And I think even if it wasn't overblown, I think it's still something we have to get past. Mm-hmm. Like even if there are sound reasons for being scared of, you know, having someone nail something into a block of wood, so what? Like fix the problem, right? Mm-hmm. Don't avoid the thing that's going to teach him the best mm-hmm. because of fear, yeah. right? Education, I mean, if you want to get philosophical about it, is, you know, basically standing up to fear in the first place. It's literally saying, I have the right to know the world around me.
And manage my small part of it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, no matter who is in charge or whatever, no matter who anything, education is what, it's the subverting thing. Right? That's why dictators everywhere, like, they want to control education, right?
Sure.
And you get, so I think we do a disservice, you know, just hitting on your point. If we're going to be educators in fear, then it's not even worth doing the job. Now, when it comes to your personal advice, right? So we said, you know, to bring this in, let's go ahead. Bring it into the classroom if you can. Mm-hmm. What about teachers wanting maybe to start you know, their own clubs, mm-hmm. or to take that process. What is some advice you would have for them to extend their signs outside of their class? What are some practical ideas that maybe you used when you tried doing this, or maybe you know now, mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. could go ahead and start implementing if this is something they wanted to do?
I think as a practical starting point, if there's an activity that you've seen in the past that was fun, do that one first. Like, do something that you've done. Something can be old hat for a teacher, but it's not for the students. Mm-hmm. And even if they've seen it before, if it's an enjoyable thing, they will enjoy it again. I get asked every year in science club, when are we doing baking soda volcanoes? And it's not because they want to be bored with it. They've seen it, and they love it, and they want to do it again. Mm-hmm. Well, we can do it. And, like, I think there's a, you know, no self-respecting science teacher is going to be caught with a volcano in their room now. That's so cliche. But, you know, the kids like it. And there are standards that can align with that. Or if it's science club and you get to break free of the standards a little bit, you could totally do that thing. Or if you're stuck, poll your people. You know, get on your Facebook or your Twitter or wherever you're at and hit folks up for, hey, you know, I need a lab, something fun to do. But I'll tell you what I did at the first, you know, when I did my very first science club. Shout out to Angie Krause. She's my principal who was brave enough to finally green light. She's like, okay, you know, don't get us sued. do your thing. And it's changed my life. Changed my life. But in that science club, I did a few that I had experience with. But when I kind of ran short on content, I went to my grocery store. I went to my grocery store and I looked for materials that I knew that I could work with. And, you know, at one point we found the whole head-on shrimp, and we dissected shrimp out of the fish case. You know, or we'd make the baking soda and vinegar, or we'd make oobleck, or some, you know, and maybe it was not standards-related at that point. Mm-hmm. I had that, you know, I have the freedom at that point to do whichever direction. But it does need to be enjoyable. That would be, if it's for the out-of-school time space, students need to enjoy it. If it's for the in-school time space, I would say the students need to enjoy it, too, if you'd like for them to remember it. That little soapbox for me there.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you want to create the... If you're going to do it, create the experience, mm-hmm. right? Don't get shy when you're trying to engage them. You know, I really like the point that you're making about, you know, having the freedom to step away from standards. And that's interesting because a lot of... You know, jumping to the fear thing, I think a lot of teachers are afraid to get away from standards, you know, because especially if they're in a tested year, mm-hmm. right? If their subject's tested, if their year is getting tested,
yes.
You know, it's almost terrifying. It's like, well, I don't have time. I'm already using time for this and blah, 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 blah. You know, all the typical excuses as to why we can't step away from the standards. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of doing that because this, I mean, tell me any subject that can be boiled down to a handful of standards.
Right.
Right? It's silly to even think about that. So, I mean, let's have a renaissance about mm-hmm. these subjects. Because reading is not all about understanding figurative language. There's nuances and all these things. And science and math and social studies are the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a list of things that you just need to memorize. And yeah, you know, the state test, you know, that's what they need, blah, 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 blah. So what? That's cool, but let's teach the subject.
Well, one important thing is the standards are, by and large, a positive statement. Mm-hmm. But knowledge, a lot of times, is going to also be those negative statements. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to know what sedimentary rock is, that's cool, but I also need to know what sedimentary rock is not.
Yeah.
And there's no statement, I mean, there's no standard saying, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this. But students still need those negative experiences or experiences about what's not in the content. I agree with you that teachers are deathly afraid of getting away from it, away from the standards. And I think administrators, you know, are also bound to those standards because our legislatures say, hey, you need to stick with it. But I think sometimes it can let us get a little bit short-sighted. Experience that I had this last school year, I was off-site visiting with some coordinators, science coordinators, and we were at the Dallas Arboretum, which is just outside nature, fabulous place. It's a wonderful place to visit. And we were talking about programs in informal spaces like zoos and museums and the Arboretum and what kind of cool things exist. And we were talking about why districts might not use those programs. And one of the coordinators said, we used that program X last year, and we took our third graders, and I heard the guide present content that was on fourth grade standards level. So I don't really want to go to that program anymore because the content they provided was a grade level ahead, and that's not efficient. Well, I didn't stomp my foot loud enough. I should have said something, but I didn't. But the students getting advanced content in the perfect environment is not inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It's wildly appropriate.
Yeah.
But because of our adherence to the state standards, it's going to hold some students back just out of fear that we're going to do it wrong or get in trouble.
Yeah, and I think that's the beautiful thing about the club thing. The club idea is, you know, say you're a teacher that is a rule follower, right? You really, you're like, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to do it. I'm going to hit these standards in this order, all that good stuff. The club, you know, starting a science club or being a partnered with someone like you who can help bring science clubs and do all these things, that frees you, right? I mean, it gets you away. Yeah, okay, fine. Do your standards. Do them however you want. Be, you know, check all your boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But give them this freedom, right? Take your kids to the next level.
That's right.
Right? Free them to, like, science. I mean, science is a dirty thing. You can't learn it just by sitting in it for 45 minutes a day. I would say that about any subject, right?
Yep.
You can't just learn it like that. You have to experience it and be a part of it, right? You don't understand literature because you read certain books. You understand literature because you read a lot.
Yep, you have to experience it.
Yeah.
I do. You know, you said that, and it made me think, I need to also calm the fears of the folks who do not particularly want to juggle rocks and play with lizards and do mm-hmm. things. Those folks can be very effective science teachers too. It's not that you have to roll in the mud. It's that you have to somehow present students with the experience so that they understand the mud. So I'm all about getting dirty, but I have seen some wonderful practitioners who could provide activities or lessons for students that weren't going to make your janitor, you know, yell at you. And I, you know, my hat's off to every janitor I've ever had, you know.
Sure.
I have to bring them cookies at Christmas and that sort of thing. But
yeah, I mean,
they take good care of me.
Totally.
Just because I still have a job, my principal would probably say. No. But you don't have to get super dirty. I figured I better put that out there because I have some wonderful science teachers I know who aren't as likely to reach elbows deep into a dead shark, you know,
for sure.
Biology class or something. And that's fine. You can do that.
Yeah, and I think that's also another thing is I've seen it from people responding to episodes of the podcast, and I've seen it just in professional developments, you know, whether it's something we're doing at the school or we went somewhere to, you know, hear some guru talk, you know, whoever, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of teachers, and it's not because they're bad teachers, right? I don't want to sound negative about anybody, but my point is coming from to where, you know, you hear all of these things, right? And we've said a lot of things that the teachers can do. And I feel like a lot of teachers sit there and like, well, like it's almost like they don't feel empowered to do something. It's like, well, why, you know, how can I?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't do it. And you said it earlier, you know, I have these types of kids or I have this type of classroom or I'm just not that type of teacher to do that, mm-hmm. right? So what would you say if you were sitting with a teacher right now who was, you know, they were listening to you, but they were resistant to this idea of doing these really involved things, you know, what type of comments would you say to someone like that to empower them to take this on?
I would ask if they're enjoying their class, and you know, if they are enjoying that and they're able to transmit that to their students, they're probably, you know, on a track that works pretty well. But if they are resistant to, you know, doing the real stuff, the teachers I met like that, they're not bad folks. They're working hard. They're, you know, working hard for the money and doing the best they can. But sometimes it can be a drag. That sort of, you know, I've taught like that before too, where I'm not into the content or I don't have the right resources and it's, you know, kicking my butt. I'd encourage them to find a way to enjoy this themselves. You know, or if they're to that point, you know, let's help the students enjoy it too. Because I think it'll bleed over from the teacher. If the teacher's enjoying themselves, they can pull the students along pretty well. You know, would you like to be sitting in your own class? If you wouldn't like to be sitting in your own class, then, you know, let's figure out how this is going to be fun for you.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a true point. And I think this has come up in another podcast, but it's like, you know, love what you're doing. Like, if you're doing something you don't like, then don't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, don't, you know, yeah, you have to teach your standards, but there's ways, you know, we all can find ways to get excited about something. Like, grammar bores me to tears. So I always have, when we cover anything grammar, I always have to do something super creative because I hate it. I mean, I hate it more than anything. Yep. And it's so stupid. Like just the concept, you know, don't get me wrong, English teachers who just had a heart attack. Like, grammar's needed. I get it. It's important. But, you know, using all of these, you know, teaching kids how to write isn't about teaching them, you know, how to conjugate something, right? It's deeper than that. So that's what I mean by that, but it's... Sure.
Well, there's so much flexibility in education.
Sure.
If you don't like teaching 7th grade, teach 6th grade. If you don't like teaching reading, teach writing. If you don't like teaching writing, teach physics. Mm-hmm. And I never understood that. And I also did not have a view of the sphere of education that influences education outside of the classroom. There's so much after-school programming. There's so much policy stakeholders... business, even business for-profit agencies that are working with educators to improve education. You don't have to be a board educator. Like, you can find something that's cool for you, and you can do it, or you can make it. You know, if it's not out there, you can make it. You can make your podcast. I mean, you do your thing and make it awesome.
What? So, you know, another question just popped up when I was listening to you talk was, you know, you have. Say that, you know, teachers, notoriously, we work long hours. We are, you know, always late. You know, we're staying grading papers or, you know, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. What about a time commitment for these clubs? What type of time are you working with? I mean, this is like, were your science clubs, the stuff that you're advocating for, is it an everyday thing, once a week, once a month? Mm-hmm. What type of time commitment would you say, someone jumping into this, a mm-hmm. teacher really wanting to push this, what type of time commitment do you think they should do for this to make it effective?
Our club, the clubs that I do, they meet once a week for 1 hour right after school. So if we get out at 3, club meets from 3:05 to 4:05, and then it's over. The prep that I'm doing, the preparation, it's going to be about something that I enjoy, or I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's science club. We're going to enjoy this. So it's either something that I've done before, and I've got access to the materials or the content, and it's easy to throw together, you know, in a way that's enjoyable, or it's something that I've been itching to try. And so I'm ready to go, you know, get that PVC pipe, or I'm ready to go, you know, get all those clothespins and strings and balloons or whatever it is. So the prep time for, you know, it could be as simple as going to the supply closet that nobody ever goes into anymore and raiding the supply closet for the water table, the stream table that you wish you could use, but you've never got time in the classroom. But the time for prep is really minimal because you're not following through on someone else's mandated lesson. Mm-hmm. It's your baby, and so you can do something that you're excited to do. And the assessment piece is really easy because generally it either doesn't exist or it's a very short progress check. If you're doing it for improving for a group of students, like say you're fifth grade, you need to bring this group up. You can have a pretest and a post-test at the end of the program. Well, a 10-minute test on the first meeting and a 10-minute test at the ending meeting, that's not going to break anybody's legs. So the time commitment really for me is 1 hour once a week, raid the science closet, you know, in my conference period.
For a really busy teacher, do you think it would be just as effective to do once every 2 weeks or once, you know, Is there a time where, like, it would just be too much space apart where it wouldn't work? Or do you think any commitment they could do would be effective?
People do that. I've known some programs that do once a month. Like, they'll say the third Thursday of the month, we're going to do Science Club. Or the first and third Tuesday. And, you know, it really is up to the teacher. You can craft this however you want to. For me, once a week lets me get to know that group of students enough to enjoy them. And that's important to me. I'm kind of a people. I like to be with my people and know them. But it's also a rare enough opportunity where we don't start to grate on each other's nerves. Because, you know, they're usually students who aren't necessarily in my class. I've got a few that are in my class that'll come to that after-school program. But, you know, if we butt heads hard during the day, that student's not, you know, they're not apt to sign up for my club, so we don't have to trouble each other after school. So that once a week thing, I really love, but I've seen lots of folks do it. You know, I know a librarian who does them as announced. You know, we have Science Club, and we'll be meeting once in September and twice in November, and then we're going to take a break.
Right.
But that's just, you know, how their model goes. Total freedom.
Yeah, there you go. So if you were one of those people that were sitting there just now shaking your head going, yeah, well, I don't have time. I got 9 kids, 10 grandbabies, 1,000 other details. Well, just do it whenever you can.
Yeah.
Because it's that important.
I think so.
Yeah, and I think that can't be stressed enough. What is it that you would love to see public schools start doing? Maybe something that they need to be doing, or a place where you see we could start advancing just from your experience in all of these classrooms and helping, you know, districts and whatnot.
I think I would encourage folks to build connections or partnerships. And I used to not understand how easy it was or how important it was, but with technology and social media, just the resources that are available to connect with, they're vast. You can get on Facebook and say, I need a lab for X. If you're, you know, if you've joined science teacher group, they'll give it to you. Or, you know, if you're a writing teacher or whatever your content area, your group exists. You just go find them. If they don't exist, you know, you're on Twitter or you're on Facebook and you just, what's a good teacher in this area do? What have you seen? And people will tell you. But I would also encourage people to expand their timeline, because when we're sitting in the classroom, our timelines are very short. It's like running down a mountain. Like, you have to look at your toes or else you're going to fall. But our timeline really should lift up away from our toes and look out more to the horizon. Because as a teacher, my timeline is, okay, Thanksgiving break, then Christmas break, then state standard test, standardized test, then last day of school, then first day of school, and then repeat. But the corporations that have these resources, who they want to partner with us, like, they've got the grant money to give us the cool stuff, or they've got the volunteers who've been dying to get into some schools to show off the new technology they've been doing. They don't have a semester horizon. They've got a 10-year, some of them have a 30-year horizon. And so they're your second grade student or your seventh grade student. These corporations are desperately needing the student you've got today to receive valuable content, and they'll help you with it. So broadening your outlook or your horizon out further in time kind of opens up the mind to saying, okay, who can I partner with in a valuable way beyond next Tuesday? And that can really open up some doors to making your practice cooler, like making it something that you'd value and get excited about, get out of bed in the morning, maybe only 3 cups of coffee instead of 4.
Sure, all right. Yeah. That's awesome. I think that's really helpful advice, though, because, you know, especially for newer teachers, too, or I guess veteran teachers, too, because it's, you know, you do, you get lost in your little echo chamber, and you're like, you forget that there's all these resources out there, especially when we start talking about district funds and how they're cutting this and cutting that. Mm-hmm. You know, it could really quickly start feeling like you have no resources.
Right.
But like you said, go to businesses, you know, startups. Sure. I mean, we're not that far from Austin.
That's right.
All kinds of startups in Austin.
Sure, sure.
I imagine willing to, you know, branch out. Public education is where it's at. They know this.
Well, in science is a content area, and then paired, partnered, you know, you hear STEM as an acronym. We don't get too far into that. But just having those skills for students, businesses know we need those skills. Mm-hmm. They know that our students that we're growing and watering today, it's important, you know, socially it's important for our students to have those skills. But it's also kind of like not just a national pride thing, but a national, it supports our country to know, you know, okay, we've got the folks in place who know how to solve problems, who know how to make things happen, who know how to deal in innovation processes and products. We need to be training these kids in science or STEM processes, and these corporations and nonprofits are really eager to help further that cause, because it's their cause. So that's part of my role at TexPost, is helping folks forge those connections and make those friendships with each other, just so teachers aren't locked in their echo chamber, but they have hands to shake and emails to reach out to people.
So if someone wanted to contact you about this, what would be What would be the your website? Would that be the best way to get a hold of you to talk to you about some of these things?
I'm a Twitter fiend. Yes. and not everybody's on Twitter. But you can find me on Twitter. I'll tell you my handle. It's at the Fort, like Fort Worth, at the Fort underscore FW. I know that's super awkward, but it's been that way for years. Now I don't want to change it. But that one, but also my website, worthlearning.org, is a fine way to reach me, and I'd be happy to connect with folks or connect with them with resources. But that's just like Fort Worth, worthlearning.org. And I love making new friends. I love, you know, reaching out and meeting people, and that's kind of how we connected. Yeah. Is just, you know, both eager to connect with another person who's enjoying what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and now I want to, real quick, I want to talk about, I got your book sitting right in front of me.
Very good. Very good.
By the way, really digging. I like the way it looks, like just as a product.
Well, thank you.
You know, and I'm gonna put a picture of it in the show notes for everyone to see. But I'm also, I want to put some links. But this is called the Science Club Handbook, so this literally connects to exactly everything we've been talking about, and I imagine goes into way more in depth.
The way I formatted the book, it tells you how to set up a club and how to get to yes with everybody who's your stakeholders on your campus. And how, you know, the logistical things that you need to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also has a collection of 10 labs to get you started.
Ooh.
And so you don't even have to plan anything for the first few. You just pick up this or that and read it like a recipe.
Yeah, you got all kinds. I mean, you got pictures in here. You got, I just saw like behavior expectations, suggested time for 1 hour labs. I mean, this is good stuff.
Well, I appreciate it. I really enjoyed writing it. And I do want to make it available to as many people as I can. Of course, you know, I'd love it if everybody goes and buys it. And,
yeah.
and go to Amazon, the Science Club Handbook.
We're gonna put the link on there for you.
That'd be awesome.
That way, if anyone on here, you know, they're listening, you know, support Alan and what he's doing because it's so important.
Well, saying that, I do want to make this book available to as many people as I can. And so I'm in Region 11. If you're outside of Texas, it's a service center area that helps a certain group of school districts. So I'm in Region 11. If there's any Region 11 folks who would like a copy, I can get to you easily because I'm in your region. And so if you want me to bring you a copy, all you need to do is tweet me and ask for one. Just tweet at the Twitter handle at the Fort underscore Fort Worth, and I'll get you a copy. I'll bring you one, and you won't have to buy it. So that would be available. Also, if you're listening to this podcast, long in the future, this won't matter. But if you're listening to it in real time as it come out, don't buy it right now. If you've got a Kindle, put it on your calendar, because on February 15th, 16th, and 17th of the year 2017, it's going to be free on Kindle. So I'll have that opened up during that time. I've got the availability to do that. So that'll be a cool way to get it, too. But if you're in Region 11, you just tweet me and ask for one. And please put in that tweet some reference to Jacob's work and Teach Me Teacher as the podcast. Because I connected with Jacob just because of the quality of this cool thing that he's got. You know, I'm listening to each episode thinking, oh, why haven't I met that person that he's talking to? And so, you know, throw some props to Jacob out in that if you do reach out. Because I'd love to, you know, make all of our spheres bigger.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the goal. So the goal of the podcast is to connect teachers with awesome ideas because, you know, the more you talk to educators or people that are passionate about education, the better ideas you get. Every person I talk to, I'm like, okay, well, how can I use this? You know, and just the things you're talking about, the talk of science, I mean, there's things I'm going to take to my class. Awesome. So this is, you know, it's part selfish, right? Because I get all the cool stuff first.
There you go.
And then everyone gets it when I release the podcast.
Nice,
but
nice.
It's definitely something awesome. But Alan, we've come to the close of the podcast. I want to thank you for coming out here on a snow day, on a Friday, right before the weekend. It was our first week back from Christmas break, so it's been a crazy week. But mm-hmm. I do want to thank you. I think your information is valid. I think it's awesome. I think this book, you know, I'm eager to dive into it and tell all my science people about it. So I want to thank you for coming out here. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me out. I truly appreciate it. It's been great.
For everyone listening, you know what to do. You go to iTunes, hit subscribe. Although with that said, I want to tell people, there's been weird technical glitches on iTunes. So if you're listening to this And you got it on iTunes. I guess you've avoided the technical glitches, but it's having weird issues. People are trying to subscribe to it. And it's saying that the feed's not valid, but I promise you we're not going anywhere. So if there's any issues on iTunes with it, you can always go to teachmeteacherpodcast.com. Every episode's up there, even no matter what issues the world is telling me I have with the podcast, it'll always be up there. You can catch us on the Facebook, give us a like on that, and just keep with us, keep talking to us. And remember, always have a good one.